can of soda and heard the rest of his story, which could be summed up in one line. He lived unhappily ever after. The one and only Roland D. LeBay had kept his small tract house, and he had kept his 1958 Plymouth. In 1965, he had hung up his night watchman's cap and his check-in clock, and somewhere around the same time, he had stopped his painstaking efforts to keep Christine looking and running like new. He had let her run down the way a man might let a watch run down. "You mean it just sat out there?" I asked. "Since 1965, for 13 years? "No, he put it in the garage, of course," LeBay said. "The neighbors would never have stood for a car just moldering away out on someone's lawn. In the country, maybe, but not in suburbia, USA." "But it was out there when we..."
"Yes, I know.
He put it out on the lawn with a for sale sign in the window. I asked about that. I was curious, and so I asked at the Legion. Most of them had lost touch with Raleigh, but one of them said he thought he'd seen the car out there on the lawn for the first time this May." I started to say something and then fell silent. A terrible idea had come to me, and that idea was simply this. It was too convenient. Much too convenient. Christine had sat in that dark garage for years, 4, 8, a dozen more. Then, a few months before Arnie and I came along and Arnie saw it, Roland LeBay had suddenly hauled it out and stuck a for sale sign on it. Later on, much later, I checked back through issues of the Pittsburgh papers and the Libertyville paper, the Keystone. He had never advertised the Fury, at least not in the papers, where you usually hawk a car that you want to sell. He just put it out on his suburban street, not even a thoroughfare, and waited for a buyer to come along. I did not completely realize the rest of the thought then, not in any logical, intellectual way at least, but I had enough of it to feel a recurrence of that cold, blue feeling of fright. It was as if he knew a buyer would be coming, if not in May, then in June, or July, or August. Sometime soon. No, I didn't get this idea logically or rationally. What came instead was a wholly visceral image. A Venus flytrap at the edge of a swamp, its green jaws wide open, waiting for an insect to land. The right insect. I remember thinking he must have given it up because he didn't want to take a chance of flunking the driver's exam, I said, finally. After you get so old, they make you take one every year or two. The renewal stops being automatic. George LeBay nodded.
"That sounds like Raleigh," he said. "But..."
"But what?"
"I remember reading somewhere, and I can't remember who said it or wrote it for the life of me, that there are times in human existence. That when it came to be steam engine time, 12 men invented steam engines. Maybe only one man got the patent or the credit in the history books, but all at once, there they were. All those people working on that one idea. How do you explain it? Just that it's steam engine time."
LeBay took a drink of his soda and looked up at the sky.
"Comes the Civil War, and all at once it's ironclad time. Then it's machine gun time. Next thing you know, it's electricity time, and wireless time, and finally it's atom bomb time. As if those ideas all come not from individuals, but from some great wave of intelligence that always keeps flowing. Some wave of intelligence that is outside of humanity."
He looked at me.
"That idea scares me if I think about it too much, Dennis. There seems to be something, well, decidedly unchristian about it."
"And for your brother, there was sell Christine time?"
"Perhaps. Ecclesiastes says there's a season for everything. A time to sow, a time to reap, a time for war, a time for peace, a time to put away the sling, and a time to gather stones together. A negative for every positive. So if there was a Christine time in Raleigh's life, there might have come a time for him to put Christine away as well. If so, he would have known it. He was an animal, and animals listen very well to their instincts." Or maybe he finally just tired of it,
LeBay finished. I nodded that that might be it, mostly because I was anxious to be gone, not because that explained it to my complete satisfaction. George LeBay hadn't seen that car on the day Arnie had yelled at me to go back. I had seen it, though. The 58 hadn't looked like a car that had been resting peacefully in a garage. It had been dirty and dented, the windshield cracked, one bumper mostly torn away. It had looked like a corpse that had been disinterred and left to decay in the sun. I thought of Veronica LeBay and shivered. As if reading my thoughts, part of them anyway, LeBay said,
I know very little about how my brother may have lived or felt during the last years of his life, but I'm quite sure of one thing, Dennis. When he felt, in 1965 or whenever it was, that it was time to put the car away, he put it away.
And when he felt it was time to put it up for sale, he put it up for sale.
He paused.
And I don't think I have anything else to tell you.
Except that I really believe your friend would be happier if he got rid of that car. I looked at him closely, your friend. He didn't look like a particularly happy young man at the present. Am I wrong about that?
I considered his question carefully. No, happiness wasn't exactly Arnie's thing, and never had been. But until the thing had begun with the Plymouth, he had seemed at least content. As if he had reached a modus vivendi with life. Not a completely happy one, but at least a workable one.
No, I said. You're not wrong. I don't believe my brother's car will make him happy. If anything, just the opposite.
And as if he had read my thoughts of a few minutes before, he went on.
I don't believe in curses, you know, not in ghosts or anything precisely supernatural. But I do believe that emotions and events have a certain lingering resonance. It may be that emotions can even communicate themselves in certain circumstances, if the circumstances are peculiar enough. The way a carton of milk will take the flavor of certain strongly spiced foods if it's left open in the refrigerator. Or perhaps that's only a ridiculous fancy on my part. Possibly it's just that I would feel better knowing that the car my niece choked in and my sister-in-law killed herself in had been pressed down into a cube of meaningless metal. Perhaps all I feel is a sense of outraged propriety.
Mr. LeBay, you said you'd hired someone to take care of your brother's house until it was sold. Was that true?
He shifted a little in his chair. No, it wasn't. I lied on impulse. I didn't like the thought of that car back in that garage, as if it had found its way home. If there are emotions and feelings that still live on, they would be there. As well as in the car herself, and very quickly he corrected himself. Itself.
Not long after, I said my goodbyes and followed my headlights home through the dark, thinking over everything LeBay had told me. I wondered if it would make any difference to Arnie if I told him one person had had a mortal accident in his car, and another had actually died in it. I pretty well knew that it wouldn't. In his own way, Arnie could be every bit as stubborn as Roland LeBay himself. The lovely little scene over the car with his parents had shown that quite conclusively. The fact that he went on taking auto shop courses down there in the Libertyville High version of the DMZ showed the same thing. I thought of LeBay saying,
I didn't like the thought of that car back in that garage, as if it had found its way home.
He had also said that his brother took the car someplace to work on it, and the only do-it-yourself garage in Libertyville now was Will Darnell's. Of course, there might have been another back in the 50s, but I didn't believe it. In my heart, what I believed was that Arnie had been working on Christine in a place where she had been worked on before. Had been. That was the operant phrase, because of the fight with Buddy Repperton. Arnie was afraid to leave it there any longer. So maybe that avenue to Christine's past was blocked off as well. And, of course,
There were no curses. Even LeBay's idea about lingering emotions was pretty far-fetched. I doubted if he really believed it himself. He had shown me an old scar, and he had used the word vengeance. And that was probably a lot closer to the truth than any phony supernatural bullshit. Of course. Now, I was 17 years old, bound for college in another year, and I didn't believe in such things as curses and emotions that linger and grow rancid, the spilled milk of dreams. I would not have granted you the power of the past to reach out horrid, dead hands toward the living. But I'm a little older now. Chapter 13. Later that evening. My mother and Elaine had gone to bed, but my dad was up, watching the 11 o'clock news on TV.
"Where you been, Dennis?" he asked.
"Bowling," I said, the lie coming naturally and instinctively to my lips. I didn't want my father to know any of this. Peculiar as it was, it really wasn't peculiar enough to be more than moderately interesting. Or so I rationalized.
"Arnie called," he said. "Asked me to have you call back if you got in before 11:30 or so."
I glanced at my watch. It was only 11:20. But hadn't I had enough of Arnie and Arnie's problems for one day?
"Well?"
"Well, what?"
"Are you going to call him?"
I sighed. "Yeah, I guess I will." I went into the kitchen, slapped together a cold chicken sandwich, poured myself a glass of Hawaiian punch, gross stuff, but I love it, and dialed Arnie's house. He picked up the phone himself on the second ring. He sounded happy and excited.
"Dennis, where you been?"
"Bowling," I said.
"Listen, I went down to Darnell's tonight, you know, and..."
"This is great, Dennis.
He gave Repperton the boot. Repperton's gone and I can stay."
That sensation of unformed dread in my belly? Again. I put my sandwich down. Suddenly, I didn't want it anymore.
"Arnie, do you think taking it back there is really such a good idea?"
"What do you mean? Repperton's gone. That doesn't sound like a good idea to you." I thought about Darnell ordering Arnie to turn off his car before it polluted his cruddy garage. Darnell telling Arnie he didn't take any shit from kids like him. I thought about the shame-faced way Arnie had cut his eyes away from mine when he told me he had gotten lift time to change his oil by doing a couple of errands. I had an idea that Darnell might find it amusing to turn Arnie into his pet gopher. It would amuse the shit out of his other regulars and his poker buddies. Arnie goes out for coffee. Arnie goes out for donuts. Arnie changes the toilet paper rolls in the crapper and loads up the Kneebrock dispenser with paper towels.
"Hey, Will, who's the four-eyes swamping out the toilet in there?" "Him. Name's Cunningham. His folks teach up at the college. He's taking a shithouse postgrad course down here."
And they would laugh. Arnie would become the local joke down at Darnell's garage on Hampton Street. I thought about those things, but I didn't say them. I figured Arnie could make up his own mind about whether he was treading water or shit. This couldn't go on forever. Arnie was just too smart. Or so I hoped. He was ugly, but he wasn't dumb.
"Repperton being gone sounds like a fine idea," I said. "It was just that I thought Darnell's was sort of a temporary measure. I mean, 20 a week, Arnie, that's pretty stiff. On top of the tool fees and the lift fees and all that happy crappy."
"That's why I thought renting Mr. LeBay's garage would be so great," Arnie said. "I figured that even at 25 a week, I'd be better off."
"Well, there you go. If you put an ad in the paper for garage space, I bet you'd..."
"No, no, let me finish," Arnie said. He was still excited.
"When I went down there this afternoon, Darnell took me aside right away. Said he was sorry about the ragging I had to take from Repperton. He said he misjudged me."
"He said that?" I guess I believed it, but I didn't trust it.
"Yeah. He asked me how I'd like to work for him part-time. 10, maybe 20 hours a week during school, putting stuff away, lubing the lifts, that kind of thing. And I can have the space for 10 a week, tool fees and lift fees at half. How does that sound?"
I thought it sounded too fucking good to be true. "Watch your ass, Arnie."
"What?"
"My dad says he's a crook."
"I haven't seen any sign of it. I think that's all just talk, Dennis. He's a loudmouth, but I think that's all."
"I'm just telling you to stay loose, that's all." I switched the phone to my other ear and drank some Hawaiian punch. Keep your eyes open and move away quick if anything starts to look heavy.
Are you talking about anything specific?
I thought of the vague stories about drugs, the more specific ones about hot cars.
No, I said. I just don't trust him.
Well, he said doubtfully, trailing away, and then came back to the original subject. Christine. With him, it always got back to Christine.
But it's a break. A real break for me, Dennis. If it works out, Christine, she's really hurting. I've been able to do some things with her, but for everything I do, it looks like there's four more. Some of it, I don't even know how to do. But I'm gonna learn.
Yeah, I said, and took a bite out of my sandwich. After my conversation with George LeBay, my enthusiasm for the subject of Arnie's best girl, Christine, had passed zero and entered the negative regions.
She needs a front end alignment? Hell, she needs a new front end. And new brake shoes? A ring job? I may try to regrind the pistons, but I can't do any of that stuff with my 54-buck Craftsman toolkit. You see what I mean, Dennis?
He sounded like he was pleading for my approval. With a sinking in my stomach, I suddenly remembered a guy we had gone to school with. Freddie Darlington, his name had been. Freddie was no ball of fire, but he was an okay kid with a good sense of humor. Then he met some slut from Penn Hills, and I mean a real slut. One more than happy to stoop for the troops, bang for the gang, pick your pejorative. She had a mean, stupid face that reminded me of the back end of a Mack truck, and she never stopped chewing gum. The stink of Juicy Fruit hung around her in a constant cloud. She got pregnant at about the same time Freddie got hung up on her. I always sort of figured he got hung up on her because she was the first girl to let him go all the way. So what happens is he drops out of school, gets a job in a warehouse, the princess has the baby, and he shows up with her at a party after the junior prom last December, wanting everything to seem the same, when nothing is the same. She's looking at all us guys with those dead, contemptuous eyes. Her jaws are going up and down like the jaws of a cow working over a particularly tasty cud, and all of us have heard the news. She's back at the bowling alley. She's back at the Libertyville wreck. She's back at Gino's. She's out cruising while Freddie is working. She's back hard at work, banging for the gang and stooping for the troops. I know they say that a stiff dick has no conscience, but I tell you now that some cunts have teeth. And when I looked at Freddie, looking 10 years older than he should have, I felt like I wanted to cry. And when he talked about her, he did it in that same pleading tone I had heard in Arnie's voice just now.
You really like her, guys, don't you? She's all right, isn't she, guys? I didn't fuck up too bad, did I, guys? I mean, this is probably just a bad dream, and I'll wake up pretty soon, right? Right? Right?
Sure, I said, into the telephone. That whole stupid, ugly Freddie Darlington business had gone through my mind in maybe 2 seconds.
I see what you mean, Arnie.
Good,
he said, relieved.
Just watch out for your ass, and that goes double when you get back to school. Keep away from Buddy Repperton.
Yeah, you bet.
Arnie.
What?
I paused. I wanted to ask him if Darnell had said anything about Christine being in his shop before, if he recognized her. Even more, I wanted to tell him what had happened to Mrs. LeBay and to her small daughter, Rita. But I couldn't. He would know right away where I had gotten the information, and in his touchy state over the damn car, he would be apt to think I'd gone behind his back. And in a way I had. But to tell him I had might well mean the end of our friendship. I'd had enough of Christine, but I still cared for Arnie, which meant that door had to be closed for good. No more creeping around and asking questions. No more lectures.
Nothing, I said.
I was just going to say that I guess you found a home for your rust bucket. Congratulations.
Dennis, are you eating something?
Yeah, chicken sandwich. Why?
You're chewing in my ear. It sounds really gross.
I began to smack as loudly as I could. Arnie made puking sounds. We both got laughing, and it was good. It was like the old days. before he married that dumb fucking car.
You're an asshole, Dennis.
That's right, I learned it from you.
Get bent, he said,
and hung up. I finished my sandwich and my Hawaiian punch, rinsed the plate and the glass, and went back into the living room, ready to shower and go to bed. I was beat. Sometime during our phone conversation, I had heard the TV go off and had assumed that my father had gone upstairs. But he hadn't. He was sitting in his recliner chair with his shirt open. I noticed with some unease how gray the hair on his chest was getting, and the way the reading lamp beside him shone through the hair on his head and showed his pink scalp. Getting thinner up there. My father was no kid. I realized with greater unease that in 5 years, by the time I would theoretically finish college, he would be 50 and balding. A stereotype accountant. 50 in 5 years if he didn't just drop dead of another heart attack. The first one had not been bad. No myocardial scarring, he had told me on the one occasion I had asked. But he did not try to tell me that a second heart attack wasn't likely. I knew it was. My mom knew it was. And he did, too. Only Ellie still thought he was invulnerable. But hadn't I seen a question in her eyes once or twice? I thought maybe I had. Died suddenly. I felt the hairs on my scalp stir suddenly, straightening up at his desk, clutching his chest suddenly, dropping his racket on the tennis court. You didn't want to think those thoughts about your father, but sometimes they come. God knows they do.
I couldn't help overhearing some of that, he said.
Yeah?
Warily. Has Arnie Cunningham got his foot in a bucket of something warm and brown, Dennis?
I don't know for sure, I said slowly, because after all, what did I have? Vapors, that was all.
You want to talk about it?
Not right now, Dad, if it's okay.
It's fine, he said. But if it, as you said on the phone, if it gets heavy, will you for God's sake tell me what's happening?
Yes.
Okay.
I started for the stairs and was almost there when he stopped me by saying,
I ran Will Darnell's accounts and did his income tax returns for almost 15 years, you know.
I turned back to him, really surprised. No, I didn't know that. My father smiled. It was a smile I had never seen before. One I would guess my mother had seen only a few times. My sis, maybe not at all. You might have thought it was a sleepy sort of smile at first, but if you looked more closely, you would have seen it was not sleepy at all. It was cynical, and hard, and totally aware.
Can you keep your mouth shut about something, Dennis?
Yes, I said. I think so.
Don't just think so.
Yes, I can.
Better. I did his figures up until 1975, and then he got Bill Upshaw over in Monroeville.
My father looked at me closely.
I won't say that Bill Upshaw is a crook, but I will say that his scruples are thin enough to read a newspaper through, and last year he bought himself a $300,000 English tutor in Sewickley. Damn the interest rates. Full speed ahead.
He gestured at our home with a small sweep of his right arm, and then let it drop back into his own lap. He and my mother had bought it the year before I was born for $62,000. It was now worth maybe $150,000. And they had only recently gotten their paper back from the bank. We had a little party in the backyard late last summer. Dad lit the barbecue, put the pink slip on the long fork, and each of us got a chance at holding it over the coals until it was gone.
No English tutor here, huh, Denny? He said.
It's fine, I said. I came back and sat down on the couch.
Darnell and I parted amicably enough, my father went on. Not that I ever cared very much for him in a personal way. I thought he was a wretch.
I nodded a little, because I liked that. It expressed my gut feelings about Will Darnell better than any profanity could.
But there's all the difference in the world between a personal relationship and a business relationship. You learn that very quickly in this business, or you give it up and start selling Fuller brushes door to door. Our business relationship was good, as far as it went. But it didn't go far enough. That's why I finally called it quits.
I don't get you.
Cash kept showing up, he said. Large amounts of cash with no clear ancestry. At Darnell's direction, I invested in two corporations, Pennsylvania Solar Heating and New York Ticketing, that sounded like two of the dummiest dummy corporations I've ever heard of. Finally, I went to see him because I wanted all my cards on the table. I told him that my professional opinion was that, if he got audited, either by the IRS or by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania tax boys, he was apt to have a great deal of explaining to do, and that before long, I was going to know too much to be an asset to him.
What did he say?
He began to dance, my father said, still wearing that sleepy, cynical smile. In my business, you start to get familiar with the steps of the dance by the time you're 38 or so. If you're good at your business, that is. And I'm not all that bad. The dance starts off with the guy asking you if you're happy with your work, if it's paying you enough. If you say you like the work, but you sure could be doing better, the guy encourages you to talk about whatever you're carrying on your back. Your house, your car, your kid's college education. Maybe you've got a wife with a taste for clothes a little fancier than she can by rights afford. See?
Sounding you out.
It's more like feeling you up, he said, and then laughed. But yeah, the dance is every bit as mannered as a minuet. There are all sorts of phrases and pauses and steps. After the guy finds out what sort of financial burdens you'd like to get rid of, he starts asking you what sort of things you'd like to have. A Cadillac, a summer place in the Catskills or the Poconos, maybe a boat. I gave a little start at that because I knew my dad wanted a boat about as badly as he wanted anything these days. A couple of times I had gone with him on sunny summer afternoons to marinas along King George Lake and Lake Passayunkie. He'd price out the smaller yachts, and I'd see the wistful look in his eyes. Now I understood it. They were out of his reach. Maybe if his life had taken a different turn, if he didn't have kids to think about putting through college, for instance, they wouldn't have been.
And you said no? I asked him. He shrugged.
I made it clear pretty early on that I didn't want to dance. For one thing, it would have meant getting more involved with him on a personal level, and as I said, I thought he was a skunk. For another thing, these guys are all fundamentally stupid about numbers, which is why so many of them have gone up on tax convictions. They think you can hide illegal income. They're sure of it. He laughed. They've all got this mystic idea that you can wash money like you wash clothes, when all you can really do is juggle it until something falls down and smashes all over your head.
Those were the reasons?
2 out of 3.
He looked in my eyes.
I'm no fucking crook, Dennis.
There was a moment of electric communication between us. Even now, 4 years later, I get goosebumps thinking of it, although I'm by no means sure that I can get it across to you. It wasn't that he treated me like an equal for the first time that night. It wasn't even that he was showing me the wistful knight-errant still hiding inside the button-down man, scrambling for a living in a dirty, hustling world. I think it was sensing him as a reality, a person who had existed long before I ever came on stage, a person who had eaten his share of mud. In that moment, I think I could have imagined him making love to my mother, both of them sweaty and working hard to make it, and not have been embarrassed. Then he dropped his eyes, grinned a defensive grin, and did his husky Nixon voice, which he was very good at.
You people deserve to know if your father is a crook. Well, I am not a crook. I could have taken the money, but that would have been wrong.
I laughed too loud, a release of tension. I felt the moment passing, and although part of me didn't want it to pass, part of me did. It was too intense. I think maybe he felt that, too.
Shh, you wake your mother and she'll give us both the devil for being up this late.
Yes, yeah, sorry. Dad, do you know what he's into, Darnell?
I didn't know then. I didn't want to know. Because then I'd be a part of it. I had my ideas, and I've heard a few things. Stolen cars, I imagine. Not that he'd run them through that garage on Hampton Street. He's not a completely stupid man, and only an idiot shits where he eats. Maybe hijacking as well.
Guns and stuff?
I asked, sounding a little hoarse. Nothing so romantic. If I had to guess, I'd guess cigarettes mostly. Cigarettes and booze, the two old standbys. Contraband, like fireworks. Maybe a shipment of microwave ovens or color TVs every once in a while, if the risk looked low. Enough to keep him busy, low these many years. He looked at me soberly. He's played the odds good. But he's also been lucky for a long time, Dennis. Oh, maybe he hasn't really needed luck here in town. If it were just Libertyville, I guess he could go on forever, or at least until he dropped dead of a heart attack. But the state tax boys are sand sharks, and the feds are great whites. He's been lucky, but one of these days they're going to fall on him like the Great Wall of China.
Have you heard things?
Not a whisper, nor am I apt to. But I like Arnie Cunningham a great deal. And I know you've been worried about this car thing.
Yeah, he's not acting healthy about it, Dad. Everything's the car, the car, the car.
People who have not had a great deal tend to do that, he said. Sometimes it's a car, sometimes it's a girl, sometimes it's a career, or a musical instrument, or an unhealthy obsession with some famous person. I went to college with a tall, ugly fellow we all called Stork. With Stork, it was his model train set. He'd been hooked on model trains ever since the third grade, and his set was pretty damn near the eighth wonder of the world. He flunked out of Brown the second semester of his freshman year. His grades were going to hell, and what it came down to was a choice between college and his Lionels. Stork picked the trains.
What happened to him?
He killed himself in 1961, my father said, and stood up. My point is just that good people can sometimes get blinded, and it's not always their fault. Probably Darnell will forget all about him. He'll just be another guy tinkering around under his car on a crawly gator. But if Darnell tries to use him, you be his eyes, Dennis. Don't let him get pulled into the dance.
All right, I'll try. But there may not be that much I can do.
Yeah, how well I know it. Want to go up?
Sure.
We went up, and tired as I was, I lay awake a long time. It had been an eventful day. Outside, a night wind tapped a branch softly against the side of the house, and far away, downtown, I heard some kid's rod peeling rubber. It made a sound in the night like a hysterical woman's desperate laughter. Chapter 14. Christine and Darnell. Between working on the construction project days and working on Christine nights, Arnie hadn't been seeing much of his folks. Relations there had been getting pretty strained and abrasive. The Cunningham house, which had always been pleasant and low-key in the past, was now an armed camp. It is a state of affairs a lot of people can remember from their teenage years, I guess. Too many, maybe. The kid is egotistical enough to think he or she is the first person in the world to discover some particular thing. Usually it's a girl, but it doesn't have to be. And the parents are too scared and stupid and possessive to want to let go of the halter. Sins on both sides. Sometimes it gets painful and outrageous. No war is as dirty and bitter as a civil war. And it was particularly painful in Arnie's case because the split had come so late, and his folks had gotten much too used to having their own way. It wouldn't be unfair to say that they had blueprinted his life. So when Michael and Regina proposed a 4-day weekend at their lakeshore cottage in upstate New York before school started again, Arnie said yes, even though he badly wanted those last 4 days to work on Christine. More and more often at work, he had told me how he was gonna show them. He was going to turn Christine into a real street rod and show them all. He had already planned to restore the car to its original bright red and ivory after the bodywork was done. But he went off with them, determined to yassa and tug his forelock for the whole 4 days and have a good time with his folks, or a reasonable facsimile.
I got over the evening before they left and was relieved to find they had both absolved me of blame in the affair of Arnie's car, which they still hadn't even seen. They had apparently decided it was a private obsession. That was fine by me. Regina was busy packing. Arnie and Michael and I got their old town canoe on top of their scout and tied it down. When it was done, Michael suggested to his son, with the air of a powerful king conferring an almost unbelievable favor on two of his favorite subjects, that Arnie go in and get a few beers. Arnie, affecting both the expression and the tones of amazed gratitude, said that would be super. As he left, he dropped a wink my way. Michael leaned against the scout and lit a cigarette.
Is he going to get tired of this car business, Denny?
I don't know, I said.
You want to do me a favor?
Sure, if I can, I said cautiously. I was pretty sure he was going to ask me to go to Arnie, act the Dutch uncle part, and try to talk him out of it. But instead he said, if you get a chance, go down to Darnell's while we're gone and see what sort of progress he's making. I'm interested.
Why is that? I asked, thinking immediately it was a pretty damn rude question, but by then it was already out.
Because I want him to succeed, he said simply, and glanced at me.
Oh, Regina's still dead set against it. If he has a car, that means he's growing up. That means all sorts of things, he finished lamely. But I'm not so down on it. You couldn't characterize me as dead set against it anyway. At least not anymore. Oh, he caught me by surprise at first. I had visions of some dead dog sitting out in front of our house until Arnie went off to college. That or him choking to death on the exhaust some night.
The thought of Veronica LeBay jumped into my head, all unbidden.
But now...
He shrugged, glanced at the door between the garage and the kitchen, dropped his cigarette and scuffed it out.
He's obviously committed. He's got his sense of self-respect on the line. I'd like to see him at least get it running.
Maybe he saw something in my face. When he went on, he sounded defensive.
I haven't quite forgotten everything about being young, he said. I know a car is important to a kid Arnie's age. Regina can't see that quite so clearly. She always got picked up. She was never faced with the problems of being the picker-upper. I remember that a car is important. If a kid's ever gonna have any dates.
So that's where he thought it was at. He saw Christine as a means to an end, rather than as the end itself. I wondered what he'd think if I told him that I didn't think Arnie had ever looked any further than getting the Fury running and legal. I wondered if that would make him more or less uneasy. The thump of the kitchen door closing.
Would you go take a look?
I guess so, I said. If you want.
Thanks.
Arnie came back with the beers.
What's the thanks for?
He asked Michael. His voice was light and humorous, but his eyes flicked between us, carefully. I noticed again that his complexion was really clearing, and his face seemed to have strengthened. For the first time, the two thoughts, Arnie and dates, didn't seem mutually exclusive. It occurred to me that his face was almost handsome. Not in any jut-jawed lifeguard king-of-the-prom way, but in an interesting, thoughtful way. He would never be Roseanne's type, but...
For helping with the canoe, Michael said casually.
Oh.
We drank our beers. I went home. The next day, the happy threesome went off together to New York, presumably to rediscover the family unity that had been lost over the latter third of the summer. The day before they were due back, I took a ride down to Darnell's garage, as much to satisfy my own curiosity as Michael Cunningham's. The garage, standing in front of the block-long lot of junked cars, looked just as attractive in daylight as it had on the evening we had brought Christine. It had all the charm of a dead gopher. I pulled into a vacant slot in front of the speed shop that Darnell also ran, well-stocked with such items as fuelly heads, Hurst shifters, and ramjet superchargers— for all those working men who had to keep their old cars running so they could continue to put bread on the table, no doubt. Not to mention a wide selection of huge mutant tires and a variety of spinner hubcaps. Looking through the window of Darnell's speed shop was like looking into a crazy automotive Disneyland. I got out and walked back across the tarmac toward the garage and the clanging sound of tools, shouts, and the machine gun blast of pneumatic wrenches. A sleazy-looking guy in a cracked leather jacket was dorking around with an old BSA bike by one of the garage bays, either removing the bike's manifold or putting it back on. There was a stutter of road rash down his left cheek. The back of his jacket displayed a skull wearing a green beret and the charming motto, "Kill 'em all and let God sort 'em out." He looked up at me with bloodshot and lunatic Rasputin eyes, then looked back at what he was doing. He had a surgical array of tools spread out beside him, each one die-stamped with the words, "Darnell's Garage." Inside, the world was full of the echoey, evocative bang of tools and the sound of men working on cars and hollering profanity at the rolling iron they were working on. Always the profanity, and always female in gender.
"Come off of there, you bitch! Come loose, you cunt! Come on over here, Rick, and help me get this twat off!"
I looked around for Darnell and didn't see him anyplace. No one took any particular notice of me, so I walked over to stall 20 where Christine sat, now pointing nose out, just like I had every right in the world to be there. In the stall to the right, two fat guys in bowling league shirts were putting a camper cap on the back of a pickup truck that had seen better days. The stall on the other side was deserted. As I approached Christine, I felt that chill coming back. There was no reason for it, but I seemed helpless to stop it. And without even thinking, I moved a bit to the left, toward the empty stall. I didn't want to be in front of her. My first thought was that Arnie's complexion had improved in tandem with Christine's. My second thought was that he was making his improvements in a strangely haphazard way. And Arnie was usually so methodical. The twisted, broken antenna had been replaced with a straight new one that glimmered under the fluorescent bars. Half the Fury's front grill had been replaced. The other half was still flecked and pitted with rust. And there was something else. I walked along her right flank to the rear bumper, frowning. Well, it was on the other side, that's all, I thought. So I walked around to the other side, and it wasn't there either. I stood by the back wall, still frowning, trying to remember. I was pretty sure that when we first saw her standing on LeBay's lawn with a for sale sign propped against her windshield, there had been a good-sized rusty dent on one side or the other near the rear end, the sort of deep dent that my grandfather always called a hoss kick. We'd be driving along the turnpike, and we'd go by a car with a big dent in it somewhere, and Grampy would say, "Hey, Denny, take a look there. Hoss kick that one." My grandfather was the sort of guy who had a down-home phrase for everything. I started to think I must have imagined it, and then gave my head a little shake. That was sloppy thinking. It had been there. I remembered it clearly. Just because it wasn't here now didn't mean it hadn't been then. Arnie had obviously knocked it out, and had done a damn good piece of bodywork covering it up. Except there was no sign that he had done anything. There was no primer paint, no gray body fill, no flaked paint, just Christine's dull red and dirty white. But it had been there, goddammit, a deep dimple filled with a snarl of rust on one side or the other. But it sure was gone now. I stood there in the clatter and thud of tools and machinery, and felt very alone and suddenly very scared. It was all wrong, it was all crazy. He had replaced the radio antenna when the tailpipe was practically dragging on the ground. He had replaced one half of the grill, but not the other. He had talked to me about doing a front-end job, but inside he had replaced the ripped and dusty back seat cover with a bright red new one. The front seat cover was still a dusty wreck, with a spring peeking through on the passenger side. I didn't like it at all. It was crazy, and it wasn't like Arnie. Something came to me, a trace of memory, and without even thinking about it, I stood back and looked at the entire car. Not just one thing here and one thing there, but everything. And I had it. It clicked into place, and the chill came back. That night, when we had brought it here, the flat tire, the replacement, I had looked at that new tire on that old car, and thought it was as if a little bit of the old car had been scratched away, and that the new car, fresh, resplendent, just off the assembly line in a year when Ike had been president and Batista had still been in charge of Cuba, was peeking through. What I was seeing now was like that, only instead of just a single new tire, there were all sorts of things. The aerial, a wink of new chrome from the grill, one taillight that was a bright, deep red, that new seat cover in the back. In its turn, that brought back something else from childhood. Arnie and I had gone to vacation Bible school together for 2 weeks each summer, and every day the teacher would tell a Bible story and leave it unfinished. Then she would give each kid a blank sheet of magic paper. And if you scraped the edge of a coin or the side of your pencil over it, a picture would gradually emerge out of the white. The dove bringing the olive branch back to Noah, the walls of Jericho tumbling down, good miracle stuff like that. It used to fascinate both of us, seeing the pictures gradually emerge, at first just lines floating in the void, and then the lines would connect with other lines. They would take on coherence, take on meaning. I looked at Arnie's Christine with growing horror, trying to shake the feeling that in her, I was seeing something terribly similar to those magic miracle pictures. I wanted to look under the hood. Suddenly, it seemed very important that I look under the hood. I went around to the front. I didn't like to stand in front of it. No good reason why not. I just didn't, and fumbled around for the hood release. I couldn't get it. Then I realized that it was probably inside. I started to go around, and then I saw something else. Something that scared me shitless. I could have been wrong about the hoss kick, I suppose. I knew I wasn't, but at least technically. But this was something else entirely. The web of cracks in the windshield was smaller. I was positive it was smaller. My mind raced back to that day a month ago when I had wandered into LeBay's garage to look at the car while Arnie went into the house with the old man to do the deal. The entire left side of the windshield had been a spider's web of cracks radiating out from one central zigzagging fault that had probably been caused by a flying stone. Now the spider's web seemed smaller, simpler. You could see into the car from that side, and you hadn't been able to before, I was sure of that. Just a trick of the light, that's all, my mind whispered. Yet I had to be wrong, because it was impossible. Simply impossible. You could replace a windshield. That was no problem if you had the money. But to make a webbing of cracks shrink? I laughed a little. It was a shaky sound, and one of the guys working on the camper cap looked up at me curiously and said something to his buddy. It was a shaky sound, but maybe better than no sound at all. Of course, it was the light and nothing more. I had seen the car for the first time with the westering sun shining fully on the flawed windshield, and I had seen it the second time in the shadows of LeBay's garage. Now I was seeing it under these high-set fluorescent tubes, three different kinds of light, and all it added up to was an optical illusion. Still, I wanted to look under the hood, more than ever. I went around to the driver's side door and gave it a yank. The door didn't open. It was locked, of course it was. All four of the door lock buttons were down. Arnie wouldn't be apt to leave it unlocked in here so anybody could get inside and poke around. Maybe Repperton was gone, but genus Creepus was weed common. I laughed again, silly old Dennis, but this time it sounded even more shrill and shaky. I was starting to feel spaced out, the way I sometimes felt the morning after I smoked a little too much pot. Locking the Fury's doors was a very natural thing to do, all right, except that when I walked around the car the first time, I thought I had noticed the door lock buttons had all been up. I stepped slowly backward again, looking at the car. It sat there, still little more than rusting hulk. I was not thinking any one thing specific, I'm quite sure of that, except maybe it was as if it knew that I wanted to get inside and pull the hood release. And because it didn't want me to do that, it had locked its own doors? That was really a very humorous idea. So humorous that I had another laugh. Several people were glancing at me now, the way that folks always glance at people who laugh for no apparent reason when they're by themselves. A big hand fell on my shoulder and turned me around. It was Darnell, with a dead stub of cigar stuck in the side of his mouth. The end of it was wet and pretty gross-looking. He was wearing small half-specs, and the eyes behind them were coldly speculative.
"What are you doing, kiddo?"
he asked.
"This ain't your property."
The guys with the camper cap were watching us avidly. One of them nudged the other and whispered something. "It belongs to a friend of mine," I said. "I brought it in with him. Maybe you remember me. I was the one with the large skin tumor on the end of my nose and the..."
"I don't give a shit if you wheeled it in on a skateboard," he said. "It ain't your property. Take your bad jokes and get lost, kid. Blow."
My father was right. He was a wretch. And I would have been more than happy to blow. I could think of at least 6,000 places I'd rather be on this second-to-last day of my summer vacation. Even the black hole of Calcutta would have been an improvement. Not a big one, maybe, yet an improvement all the same. But the car bothered me. A lot of little things, all adding up to a big itch that needed to be scratched. "Be his eyes," my father had said. And that sounded good. The problem was, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. "My name is Dennis Gilder," I said. "My dad used to do your books, didn't he?" He looked at me for a long time with no expression at all in his cold little pig eyes. And I was suddenly sure he was going to tell me he didn't give a fuck who my father was, that I'd better blow and let these working men go about the business of fixing their cars so they could go on putting bread on their tables, etc. Then he smiled, but the smile didn't touch his eyes at all.
"You're Kenny Gilder's boy?"
"Yes, that's right." He patted the hood of Arnie's car with one pale, fat hand. There were two rings on it, and one of them looked like a real diamond. Still, what does a kid like me know?
"I guess you're straight enough, then, if you're Kenny's kid."
There was a second when I thought he was going to ask for some identification. The two guys next to us had gone back to work on their camper, apparently having decided nothing interesting was going to transpire.
"Come on into the office and let's have a talk," he said,
then turned away and moved across the floor without even a glance backward. That I would comply was taken for granted. He moved like a ship under full sail, his white shirt billowing, the girth of his hips and backside amazing, improbable. Very fat people always affect me that way, with a feeling of distinct improbability, as if I were looking at a very good optical illusion. But then I come from a long line of skinny people. For my family, I'm a heavyweight. He paused here and there on his way back to his office, which had a glass wall looking out onto the garage. He reminded me a little bit of Moloch, the god we read about in my Origins of Literature class. He was the one who was supposed to be able to see everywhere with his one red eye. Darnell bawled at one guy to get the hose on his tailpipe before he threw him out. Yelled something to another guy about how Nicky's back was acting up on him again. This inspired a fuming, ferocious burst of laughter from both of them. Hollered at another guy to pick up those fucking Pepsi-Cola cans, was he born in a dump. Apparently Will Darnell didn't know anything about what my mother always called a normal tone of voice. After a moment's hesitation, I followed him. Curiosity killed the cat, I suppose. His office was done in early American carburetor. It was every scuzzy garage office from coast to coast in a country that runs on rubber and amber gold. There was a greasy calendar with a pin-up of a blonde goddess in short shorts and an open blouse climbing over a fence in the country. There were unreadable plaques from half a dozen companies which sold auto parts, stacks of ledgers, an ancient adding machine. There was a photograph, God save us, of Will Darnell wearing a Shriner's fez and mounted on a miniature motorcycle that looked about to collapse under his bulk. And there was the smell of long-departed cigars and sweat. Darnell sat down in a swivel chair with wooden arms. The cushion wheezed beneath him. It sounded tired, but resigned. He leaned back. He took a match from the hollow head of a ceramic Negro jockey. He struck it on a strip of sandpaper that ran along the edge of his desk and fired up the wet stub of cigar. He coughed long and hard, his big loose chest heaving up and down. Directly behind him, tacked to the wall, was a picture of Garfield the cat. "Want a trip to Loose Tooth City?" Garfield was inquiring over one cocked paw. It seemed to sum up Will Darnell, wretch in residence, perfectly.
"Want a Pepsi, kid?"
"No, thank you," I said, and sat down in the straight chair opposite him. He looked at me, that cold look of appraisal again, and then nodded.
"How's your dad, Dennis? Is Ticker still okay?"
"He's fine. When I told him Arnie had his car here, he remembered you right off. He says Bill Upshaw's doing your figures now."
"Yeah, good man. Good man. Not as good as your dad, but good."
I nodded. A silence fell between us, and I began to feel uneasy. Will Darnell didn't look uneasy. He didn't look anything at all. That cold look of appraisal never changed.
"Did your buddy send you to find out if Repperton was really gone?" he asked me so suddenly that I jumped.
"No," I said. "Not at all."
"Will you tell him he is?"
Darnell went on, ignoring what I just said.
"Little wise ass. I tell him when they run their junk in here, get along or get out. He was working for me, doing a little of this and a little of that, and I guess he thought he had the gold key to the crapper or something. Little wise-ass punk."
He started coughing again, and it was a long time before he stopped. It was a sick sound. I was beginning to feel claustrophobic in the office, even with the window looking out on the garage.
"Arnie's a good boy,"
Darnell said presently, still measuring me with his eyes. Even while he was coughing, that expression hadn't changed.
"He's picked up the slack real good."
"Doing what?" I wanted to ask, and just didn't dare. Darnell told me anyway. Cold glance aside, he was apparently feeling expansive.
"Sweeps the floor, takes the crap out of the garage bays at the end of the day, keeps the tools inventoried along with Jimmy Sykes. Have to be careful with tools around here, Dennis. They got a way of walking away when your back's turned."
He laughed, and the laugh turned into a wheeze.
"Got him started stripping parts out back as well. He's got good hands. Good hands and bad taste in cars. I ain't seen such a dog as that 58 in years."
"Well, I guess he sees it as a hobby," I said.
"Sure,"
Darnell said expansively.
"Sure he does. Just as long as he doesn't want to ramrod around with it like that punk, that Repperton. But not much chance of that for a while, huh?"
"I guess not. It looks pretty wasted."
"What the fuck is he doing to it?"
Darnell asked. He leaned forward suddenly, his big shoulders going up all the way to his hairline. His brows pulled in, and his eyes disappeared except for small twin gleams.
"What the fuck is he up to? I've been in this business all my life, and I never seen anyone go at fixing a car up the crazy-ass way he is. Is it a joke, a game?"
"I'm not getting you," I said, although I was. I was getting him perfectly.
"Then I'll draw you a picture,"
Darnell said.
"He brings it in, and at first he's doing all the things I'd expect him to do. What the fuck? He ain't got money falling out of his asshole, right? If he did, he wouldn't be here. He changes the oil, he changes the filter, grease job, lube. I see one day he's got two new Firestones for the front to go with the two on the back."
"Two on the back?" I wondered, and then decided he just bought three new tires to go with the original new one I'd gotten the night we were bringing it over here.
"Then I come in one day and see he's replaced the windshield wipers,"
Darnell continued.
"Not so strange, except that the car's not going to be going anywhere, rain or shine, for a long time. Then it's a new antenna for the radio, and I think he's going to listen to the radio while he's working on it and drain his battery. Now he's got one new seat cover and half a grill. So what is it, a game?"
"I don't know," I said. "Did he buy the replacement parts from you?"
"No,"
Darnell said, sounding aggravated.
"I don't know where he gets them. That grill? There isn't a spot of rust on it. He must have ordered it from somewhere. Custom Chrysler in New Jersey or someplace like that. But where's the other half? Up his ass? I never even heard of a grill that came in two pieces."
"I don't know, honest." He jammed the cigar out.
"Don't tell me you're not curious, though. I saw the way you was looking at that car."
I shrugged. "Arnie doesn't talk about it much," I said.
"No, I bet he doesn't. He's a closed-mouthed son of a bitch. He's a fighter, though. That Repperton pushed the wrong button when he started in on Cunningham. If he works out okay this fall, I might find a steady job for him this winter. Jimmy Sykes is a good boy, but he ain't much in the brains department.
His eyes measured me.
Think he's a pretty good worker, Dennis?
He's okay.
I got a lot of irons in the fire, he said. A lot of irons.